Partially rainy, partially hard to find kind of talk event that we have today.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, my name is Andrew Goldstein. I'm the editor-in-chief of ArtNet News. I'm very happy to be here with Pace Gallery CEO and president Mark Glimcher. This is going to be a little bit of a love letter to the art industry, to the art world, I think. Mm-hmm. It might have a little tough love in there somewhere.
Yeah, a lot of tough love.
Maybe a little tough love. I think that it is appropriate that we are here at the Shelley Lansing Theater Sherry Lansing Theater at Paramount Studios, because Paramount is the poster child of a once dominant cultural leader that has been entirely disrupted by the forces that are sweeping through the culture at large. It was one of Hollywood's major studios in history. It turned out movies like Chinatown, The Godfather, Rosemary's Baby, and it, had a great run until recently, when it got totally outmoded by competition coming from streaming, from Netflix, from television. Mm-hmm. They cut their television, production. And as a result, they've been completely, now they're fighting for survival. They're going through a very dramatic turnaround operation. I say that because the art world is one of the few businesses in the cultural arena that has not been disrupted. It is one of the, media, music, everything else has been disrupted, but art has proven very resilient to change.
Yes.
And, you can see this because if you go to the art fair, that's just a, 15, 20 minute walk away from here, I guess, you will find a lot of painting and sculpture that is hanging on the walls.
Yes.
And painting and sculpture is, it's dealing with a lot of cutting edge themes. The subject matter has changed. The mode of manufacture may have changed, but it's still something that, people are putting on the wall above their, above their sofa. They're putting in storage. They're
fantastic 14th century technology.
Exactly. It's and it's a kind of technology that people who came to your father, to Arnie Glimcher's gallery when he opened it in 1960, would be very comfortable and recognize. The basic format is pretty much unchanged. Pace Gallery is one of the great historic art galleries, in the field today. It's 16 locations all around the world, representing 12, dozens of historic artists, and had a great history of championing Rothko, Louise Nevelson, great artists from the historical era of the post-war period to today. But the thing that is so remarkable about Pace Gallery is that while it has such a great history that it sits upon, it is still very forward-looking and unusually forward-looking. And so we're here to talk about the future of the art gallery.
Talk about the future.
So, Mark, you were telling me, I saw you in Taipei a little while ago.
And yes.
You were telling me that there was a point in history where it didn't seem that painting was going to be the wave of the future. And what happened?
It's a very good question. So when I was a kid in the 70s, we were told that painting was dead. And that didn't literally mean that, people were going to stop making paintings. But it meant that the leading edge of art, and art had a leading edge, from somewhere in the late 1800s right to 1970, was artists who referred to their work as phenomenological. Mm-hmm. And this was, there was a lot that was based in Bob Irwin's students and his classes at CalArts. They were definitely coming off of the happenings era, which had happened prior to that. Painting was dead was the idea that the artists were progressing past the creation of an object, which creates the art experience, to creating a conditioned environment which would create the art experience, which would have no limitations, would not have the limitation of having to be purchased by a very wealthy person, visited in a museum, that artists were going to expand to become, the aesthetic experience of life. And this was pretty well accepted, that painting was dead. And we, meaning the art world, the art business, or whatever you call it, interestingly did not offer those artists a business model. Mm-hmm. My father took on Robert Irwin, he took on James Turrell, but there was no business model. The business model was to beg, borrow, and steal, and sell souvenirs. And, you know,
what
somehow,
do you mean by souvenirs?
You know, sell some painting or a sculpture, something you could actually sell, and somehow raise the money by hook or by crook to create this environment or experience like the Rodin Crater, which has been trying to come into existence since 1970. So we didn't offer any business model. Lo and behold, painting came back. What a shock, you know? Painting came roaring back in 1980, and it has, you know, progressed since then in very powerful ways. So the question is, what was that business model that they weren't offered? It's not very complicated. Mm-hmm. The only business model for experiential art is one that is linked to a very large audience. There is no, you know, the business model, if experiences are linked to a small audience, are not business. It's philanthropy.
Right.
And you know, art cannot survive on philanthropy alone. Mm-hmm. It never has. Mm-hmm. Okay. The history of art is the history of people trading real value and real goods for the spiritual and ephemeral value of art. That is the dance between the patron and the artist, the collector and the artist. And what we saw, you know, Peter Boris, who's sitting here in this audience, came to me about 5 years ago and started showing me the work of some artists, particularly Team Lab. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they knew what the model is, which is that you sell tickets.
Fascinating.
Right. Sell tickets. And, you know, in our world, you only sell tickets as a donation to a nonprofit. Anything else is low. Mm-hmm. Anything else is debased. If you sell tickets to see art, it's okay to sell tickets to see a movie, dance, music, theater, but not art.
Or actually a museum or an
museum,
art fair.
Museum,
or
yeah.
Anything other than a gallery, essentially.
Yeah, and if you know, the way that the, and people might think that's how the art dealer gets paid. That's how the artist gets paid. So the general public is not permitted to pay the artists. They pay institutions which are supported by ultra high worth, net worth individuals. And those institutions bring wealthy people's art to be in a place where everyone can visit it by making a small donation. Mm-hmm. There are no connection there between the artist and the public.
I mean, I think it's fascinating that you look back at, you know, there's a lot of attention paid to people like Van Gogh, you know, who lived in poverty and died in obscurity. There's less attention paid to the crucial factor that a business model, you know, provides for the creation of art. Because if you have a business model to make paintings, people are going to make paintings. If you have a business right. model to make to do something else that is transformative, that is experiential, people are going to do that
right.
more
well,
often.
It really is the other way around.
I mean,
it's the other way around. People make paintings, and they are great. Mm-hmm. So a business model is attracted to them so that it can go and penetrate the world. Experiential art is very young, and it is attracting. Even if it didn't happen in the 70s, this is a relatively short period of time. And it will attract a business model because it's creating something that there's a fundamental demand for in our world, mm-hmm. which is a whole other story.
I mean, it's interesting that, you know, you had a Team Lab show in Palo Alto recently where you had a few of these domestically scaled kinds of, you know, pieces from Team Lab's overarching of, you know, of the same kind that you have in the booth today. But what's fascinating about TeamLab is that I've heard that this accounts for maybe 10% of their overall revenue, and that 90% of it is actually coming from the ticketing sales. Maybe that's a little
fuzzy. That was a misquote, but okay.
Okay.
We don't know. We don't know. We don't talk about how TeamLab makes their money. But we do know that millions of people around the world buy a ticket to see TeamLab.
Mm-hmm.
We know that they're not burdened by kind of some old-fashioned idea about what artists are supposed to do and not to do. And we know that their practice, which is, you know, now 600 plus people, is supported by the general public, not by a few art collectors.
I mean, the thing that has made it very hard for art to compete in this kind of, you know, this new arena, is because it's the scale question. You know, the art world is tiny, comparatively speaking. I think that, you know, I heard that 500,000 people came to see the TeamLab, you know, events over three different galleries over the course of a year.
A million.
A million?
Sorry, go ahead.
But there was, I think, anyway, I got some information that was, it said five, but if it's a million, yeah. You know, say that you charge $20 per ticket.
Mm-hmm.
You can bring in something that is roughly equivalent to twice what, you know, Beyonce and Jay-Z made in 2 days of a concert in London over the past year. So the scale is so infinitesimal that, you know, it has made it difficult to meaningfully bring this kind of model to the art world. And I wonder what is the way forward? What is the way to actually make that something that is sustainable beyond something you know, like a team lab, and have it be a little bit more inclusive of other kinds of practice.
Okay, well, let's go back a little bit to all your nice slides too. Okay. I mean, I think that it's important to back up. I mean, the business model is a fascinating conversation, and I think it's evolving. But I think it is important to understand that, you know, art has an audience. And that the artists have created something that is necessary for living in our world. That, you know, to go back to that, the museums, I mean, the museums are the biggest tourist attraction in every city all around the world. Cool. Every major city, their biggest tourist attraction in every one of those cities is the art museum. So I think, you know, the fundamental here is that artists create something that makes it possible for us to live the way we live. You know, modern art started with the first wave of urbanization. You know, there have been waves of urbanization that drive and changes in society that drive artistic production. It's really the uniqueness of the artist's product that has kept it in this strange place, in where even here in our modern world, in our communication era, when there's so much contact for people with art, we have, you know, 800,000 Instagram followers and 1,000 clients. Hmm. I mean, and I'm exaggerating by saying 1,000 clients, by the way. And, you know, who are those 700,000 people? They're passionate about art, and art is a necessary part of their life. So I think that's, you know, a key to understanding. You have a great slide in here of Frederick Church.
Oh, like, okay. That slide. Well, we can skip.
Did you go? Is that forward? Sorry,
We're getting a sneak preview.
Right. Exactly.
Here we go. So.
You go ahead.
So this is a painting by Frederick Church from 1857. He painted of Niagara Falls, and he debuted it in a gallery in New York City, and he charged 25 cents per person to have you know, ticketed entry to see the show. And it was lit by, you know, dramatic lighting. It was put in this kind of, like, you know, cinematographic kind of context. And I think 100,000 people came and saw it over the course of 2 weeks. And it made him a very wealthy man. He toured the world. He sold like chromiographs of the painting, and it was a huge success. And that I think that it's an interesting thing to bring in, because it shows you that it's not really necessarily the medium that you are that is driving the different kind of revenue streams, but actually the presentation and the way that it is is framed for the viewer. I mean, if you look at an art fair is essentially a vast ticketed art event.
Right.
It's just that the people who are supposedly or potentially going to buy are given the tickets for free. Everybody who's not going to buy.
Well, the people who are buying in the art fair over there are, and the people who are selling, are financing a ticketed art event.
Right.
An experiential thing. The audience is obviously 90% non-buyers, but they're buying something. They're buying this experience.
And I think that, it's interesting to look at the way that your gallery has developed. Since you kind of took the reins, there was historically a lot of focus on rule-based abstraction. And that has widened, in recent years to involve a lot of artists who are working with this kind of experiential model of art. We've got Ralph from Studio Drift in the audience today. You've been working with JR. You've been working with, a bunch of very talented artists. I mean, Random International, right, who did the famous Rain Room. These are artists who are working in something that is very different from the traditional mode of art that you see in a gallery or museum. And I wonder, how did that transition happen, and what was it that gravitated you to these people?
So I think, just skip back on your slides again, it really, going back to the 1970s, it goes back to a very foundational part of Pace Gallery, where my father went out to California, met Bob Irwin and Larry Bell, and became, after being a frequenter of the happenings, became very interested in this idea of phenomenological art, conditional art, and brought them back to New York and started showing their work, trying to figure out a way to show their work. I remember when I was 11 years old, I walked into the gallery and there was just a white room. And after a few minutes, I realized that one of the walls was sort of out of focus. And this was Irwin's famous soft wall, where he stretched a scrim in front of the back wall of the gallery, just 6 inches in front of the wall. It was perfect seams, it was invisible, but the wall was not quite right. And that was a very, formative experience for me. So we have a history of believing that these kinds of artists are pushing the critical dialogue and examination of how to advance human perception in a very important way. As do painters and sculptors. But this is an important, piece of the puzzle, and it needs special kind of attention. So I think that when 5 or 6 years ago we started talking to some artists like Hannes and Flo at Random International and Inoko at Team Lab, we saw some kind of, these artists were absolutely passionate about Irwin, Terrell, De Maria, and everything that had been done in that era. And so we saw a kinship there. And so we wanted to follow the artists. I mean, this is what the job is to follow the artists.
And so, historically, you've supported these artists by selling work that is peripheral, adjacent kinds of work.
Right.
I mean, somebody like James Terrell, there were great shows of his holographic paintings. Mm-hmm. These are, incredibly important. They're great pieces, but they are fractional compared to the, you know, the significance of something like Roden Crater.
Correct.
So Roden Crater is, it's extraordinary to think that, and here's Franchise Freedom. This is Team Lab's, you know, drone ballet that they did in the sky over Art Basel, Miami Beach in 2017, has traveled the world. But here, you know, so this is Roden Crater, which James Turrell has been working on since 1977, which is extraordinary because it's going to debut at precisely the moment that the society is hungry for these kinds of, you know, really sublime, in-person, be-here-now experiences. I mean, everybody is consumed by screens constantly, and there's a real hunger for something that connects you to, you know, a lived experience, to a communal experience, to something that is, that kind of makes you feel alive. And so just the idea that this is something that has been, you know, gestating for, you know, over four decades is extraordinary. What kind of impact do you think it's going to have when this thing debuts?
Well, I think it's the crater. The crater has a life-changing impact when you go. Very, very few people have had the pleasure to be able to experience it. I think that it does what art is supposed to do, which is that it makes large swaths of your universe that were previously invisible, you know, visible to you. Hmm. It makes the world more beautiful. Hmm. After having that experience, that's how you take it away with you. It also connects you in a way to the people you're there with. Hmm. I think that, you know, this is absolutely central and essential quality of art, is that it is a connection between people beyond knowing each other, intimacy, whatever ways we connect with people. This is the way we connect with people we don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I think the importance of that is pretty clear in our world today. Mm-hmm. And in an increasingly concentrated world of problems and overpopulation, this is a unique survival tool. Hmm. And I think experiential environmental art is pretty much on the top of that list.
So this has been in progress since 1977. You have a architectural project of your own that you've been working on recently, and it's not the headquarters of somebody trying to take over the world in a James Bond movie.
No.
This is a Pace Gallery's new gigantic space on 25th Street that is going to debut this fall. And I wonder, maybe can you say a little bit about what problems this space was intended to solve? What is it that this gallery is going to give?
It's going to solve the problem of us having any liquid. Sorry, just kidding. what is it going to solve? I don't know if it's going to solve anything except we've been in the same crappy space since I was 5 years old and I'm sick of it. But beyond that, we are attempting to create a gallery that's highly transparent. That there's a library there that's open to the public. There's storage there that's open to the public. There's great outdoor spaces. And we have prioritized on the very top there a kind of performance space, experience space, which is not about a show for 5 weekends install. It is got the flexibility to do something else that maybe we don't exactly know what it is right now, but. It was supposed to solve the problem, finally, of the gallery being about a velvet rope that a few people knew they could pass through. Now, I don't know any gallerist today who would say, that's our goal. Our goal is to make this super exclusive, disconnected from the majority type of experience. Mm-hmm. Proactively trying to create an open experience is something that I think it really we're just starting to figure out how to do that. So this is going to be an attempt to do that. This is going to be an attempt to offer the artists some flexibility in spaces to, you know, come up with something different. We're going to have beautiful painting shows in this space. We're going to have beautiful sculpture shows in this space. But it will have the capability to do more.
I mean, it's interesting because I had the chance to go visit MoMA's construction site for their new building the day before I came and did a tour of your new space. And what's kind of remarkable is that that MoMA and places like The Shed, Bloomberg Shed, are building these huge column-free spaces that are central. You know, the MoMA has a giant column-free space in the center of its new building right. that is devoted to performance, experiential kinds of art.
Right.
And these spaces are being built in anticipation that the art is going to arrive at
right.
some point and fill it. And I think that that is a, it's very interesting because you go to something like Hauser & Wirth space, you know, in downtown LA,
mm-hmm.
that is based on a model of a museum. You walk into there, you know, they have an information desk, they have a, there's a gift store, there's a cafe. I mean, you know, it is indistinguishable in many ways from a very nice museum. Your building seems like it has a different kind of model. Or tell me how do you think of your building as relating to a museum? How is it kind of the same and different?
I think that you know, I think the museum model is very powerful. I think that maybe it isn't such a lifestyle model. We really have prioritized the spaces to be experimental in the way they can be utilized by the artists. You kind of have to make choices. Even if you have 70,000 square feet, you have to make a lot of choices. You're on a patch of land that's 100 feet by 100 feet. And so, I mean, I don't know. I think the Hauser & Wirth space here is, you know, is really novel. And they have a lot more spaces that they, in that building, that they're probably going to use in some very interesting and experimental ways. So, but, you know, I think the museums are, in the museums for a long time, you heard, wow, the galleries are competing with us, you know, this, they're doing all these, you know, incredible, you know, exhibitions and so forth. I think the museums are incredibly forward-looking. I think at this point, museums are more forward-looking than the galleries. They want to engage with a larger audience. And we're just stuck with this idea that we have this tiny audience that we are here to serve. And we have forgotten that that tiny audience is created through the larger audience. And the fact that it means something, that the you know, we have a little problem that we have the kind of arbitrage-based art economy. Okay, it's gotten to this point where we think that the value of the artwork comes from the last auction sale, which is not where the value comes from. It may be evidence of the value that's been assigned to it, but the value comes from some fundamental qualities of the art. You know, if you get too into your arbitrage-based system and lose sight of that and create all your models around, you know, these rarefied events of very expensive art being sold at auction or art fairs or whatever, you know, you're losing sight of the thing that's giving the art value. So if you're going to build a new kind of gallery, if you're going to build any new kind of systems in the art world, they have to be pegged to the thing that is the true value, which is what the artists create.
And so I have to ask, is there going to be a ticket booth in the
No ticket booth, no.
How are you planning to do any kind of will there be a ticketing kind of component built in, like that you were experimenting with in Beijing, Palo Alto, I believe, and not London?
Not London, no.
Right.
We are pondering it. We are pondering it, yeah. What was that? We're trying to come up with an idea. It isn't necessarily this building. Mm-hmm. I think that if we think about it, we listen to the artists. The model is going to like grow wings. Okay. And it requires going beyond even something like this.
Isn't Team Lab is building their own space and with participation from Pace in Brooklyn, if I recall, and I think that is going to be a gigantic, gigantic experience, kind of experience-atorium.
Right.
Is that the kind of thing that you're thinking about?
We are thinking about it. I think it's very important to to think about those 799,000 people on your Instagram.
I mean, what I think is fascinating about what you're doing is that, you know, there are very few art businesses that are positioned to be able to experiment in such a headlong fashion because you work with so many artists from history whose work is very much baked into the art market. You have a great estates. You have spectacular artists who, have collector bases all around the world, and so you're able to experiment with these new forms of a business model that could be ticketing. And you know, I wonder. It kind of makes me think that something is happening in the art business that is equivalent to what happened with the rise of the studio system in Hollywood.
Agreed.
You know, I think that that's a huge change because. Before the studio system, there were a lot of small, filmmakers, right. Producers, but they, the studios hoovered up all the talent. They built huge vertically integrated operations, and they turned out, the golden age of cinema.
Right.
And what do you think, how do you see that applying to the state of the art world? It seems like it's on the precipice of a lot of change.
Yeah, I think it is. I think that the artist practices are progressing. Again, it's tied to the audience. You know, the studio system was created because the audience for film was growing so rapidly. It wasn't the other way around. It wasn't that, we're going to build all these huge systems and then hopefully people are going to be interested. Artists who sat alone in their studio making a painting, even if they still sit at home in their studio making a painting, there is call for their work and their participation in communities all over the world. That call, that demand starts to build, and it starts to build towards this kind of studio system. I mean, I think that the studio system has obviously, as you said in the beginning, gone through a lot of evolution, but the idea of an organization that can facilitate art making is a new idea. It's a great old idea from the 20th century, from the movie and the music world and so forth. But it's a new idea for us. We've been edging towards it steadily, since the 1980s. But we were an institution where we came to discern art quality and then support the art collector. We represent the artist, but our job was to move the art from the artist studio, be the connector between the artist and the collector, two kinds of people that never connected. Now, obviously, they connect all the time. To go from that to being a place that facilitates the production and distribution of art all over the world is a difficult evolution. you know, for I think for a long time in the 90s and the early 2000s, you know, we were starting to look for disruption in the art world, and we looked to the internet, right? The internet's going to disrupt every other kind of retail business. It's going to disrupt ours, and you know, we saw ArtNet as a disruptor. We saw Artsy as a disruptor. They were never going to be the disruptors, no offense, but the artists were always going to be the disruptors, and so we weren't ready for that. We are not a retail business. We are an experience business. We're the first experience business. We're an experience business with the world's most expensive gift shop. Huh. But art gets its value through experience. So internet, retail, merchandise, whatever that whole system was never going to disrupt. It was the artists wanting to connect to the people. That's the disruption that was always going to happen. You know, it happened in the, all you have to do is look at the music, history of music, and read David Byrne's brilliant book about it. You know, music was made by a few people who were, you know, underwritten by a patron class, and then maybe it trickled down to the world. By the avant-garde disrupting the musical system, whether that was jazz or, you know, all kinds of early 20th century music or modern music or theater. They broke down the patronage system. And then technology came in and it created this whole new system where art, where the music connected to the general public. Mm-hmm. Pop music, right? Elvis Presley. We haven't had that happen yet. We haven't really had pop art yet, and it's coming.
Yeah.
So, you know, you watch for those disruptions by seeing when the audience and technology connect, they're going to come in and change the way, you know, art, any version of the arts are made, consumed, etc. The studio system is a method for undergoing that transformation.
You know, it's great that we're here in LA because this is where there are a lot of industries that have been fusing historically. You've got music, television, cinema, and it so happens that a lot of the most interesting things that that I see happening in art are coming from adjacent industries. So you have something like Inarritu creating his incredible VR experience.
Arena, yeah.
You know, Team Lab kind of coming from something that's
they
like
came from a digital, you know, design group.
So this is the kind of background, maybe more so than you know, an MFA program that could potentially deliver the skill sets that are required for this kind of next generation of pop art, which is a great way of putting it. The thing that's so interesting, though, is that there's always been a kind of a, you know, the business model for doing this is fractional charges and subscription models are the things that have disrupted every other industry.
Right.
Tickets are like one potential way of doing that in the art business. However, it's always been kind of somehow frowned upon. Right. It hasn't been. And why do you think that is? Why is it that the gallery is the place that is the only one that cannot charge ticketing?
Okay, so the art object is a sacred object. You know, we lost religion in some ways in society. The artists come in as these sacred people creating sacred objects. There's a whole economy based on these sacred objects. The wealthiest people in the world are very invested in that economy of these sacred objects, as are we all. So that becomes hard to disrupt, and anything that seems popular, that would a sacred object is kind of, you know, left for very few. There's, you know, people to guard. something that everyone's invited to seems, you know, if those things are sacred, that's profane. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, baked in this idea that what keeps art sacred is it's so rare, so rarefied. Mm. Okay. So now we put on the hedge fund people come into the art world. You know, Damien Hirst comes into the art world in the phenomenon of the 90s, and we see that the artists are going to take this sacred object and they're going to run with it, okay? And they're going to expand the commercialization of that sacred object. So then we have, you know, now people out there talking about fractional ownership of art, and, you know, we had this big blockchain conversation in Miami. So all of these ideas of trying to, on the one hand, keep art the sacred thing, but we're going to highly commercialize it within a small group of ultra-wealthy people. The artists won't stand for it. Mm-hmm. The artists insist on meaning. And right now, for a lot of artists, that means reaching a much larger audience. For a lot of artists, that means decommodification and democratization of art. There are other trends of, you know, a meaning-based art world that we see all over the world. But the disruption comes, you know, in a way that always looks like it's like like that art form is being debased. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we can't, we have to, as I always say, you have to follow the artists. And if, you know, they want to go out and connect to a mass audience, that is not, you know, that does not, does not debase their work. If you try to create sacred objects and have them connect to a mass audience, you know, that might be riskier, you know, towards debasing the work. If we look at some of the stories of artist overproduction and so forth. Hmm. So it's a lot of trends and ideas that are kind of wound up on each other, and it's a complicated ecosystem. But I think we are very close to seeing it starting to sort out in some novel ways.
One kind of downer of a note is that, you know, we see smaller galleries all over the world struggling because they have, you know, rising rent. They have you know, the need to travel the world and follow an ever, you know, growing kind of you know, international collector base, because fewer and fewer people are going to their gallery because their gallery is a small, you know, one room space in a downtown area that has, you know, paintings and sculpture on the wall. And what's kind of interesting is that that there's a lot of effort and thinking being put towards maintaining that model, you know, in a way that is sustainable for everybody, so that that they'll be able to pay, you know, sell more paintings to more people, you know, in order to transition to this new kind of market environment. And what's interesting is that you were saying about the artists leading the way. It's a tricky thing because it seems like this kind of disruption will not disrupt the biggest players. It will disrupt the smallest players in a large way.
The you know, it's not the art world is not a, you know, it's not fair. Okay, this is not a forum for fairness. It's not, if you want decide you want to be an artist. Okay, no one is going to be fair to you. Okay, you've made that crazy decision yourself that you want to put your life into art. Okay, the chances are, no one's going to listen. Okay, so all of us who want to be in the art world, if we're looking for fairness, you know, look somewhere else, because what we don't want that. We don't want, you know, everybody to have an equal crack at being a successful artist, then that means everyone shouldn't have an equal crack at being a successful art gallery. You know, we have a very important nonprofit system in place, which I believe is essential to the ecosystem. That nonprofit, you know, system is there to try and give, you know, recognition to unheard voices. I think that's something that's happening more and more. Mm-hmm. You know, but if you are going to go out there and be a young gallery and you're looking for, you know, a system of social assistance to allow you to, you know, I don't think this is that kind of ecosystem.
It's a strange paradox where a small gallery is a nonprofit essentially that has a for-profit business model. It doesn't make that much sense. So I think that before opening things up to questions, you know, another element of the studio system is that the artists are starting to make movies like Julian Schnabel's great Van Gogh movie. But I just wanted to kind of round up on this slide because this is a fascinating, you know, kind of cultural moment where Netflix is worried about being disrupted itself by the video game industry. And so here is, this is a guy named DJ Marshmallow who just played a set in Fortnite a few weeks ago that was watched by 10 million concurrent virtual avatars, which is like, I just got chills thinking about that. That kind of audience is out there. You know, this is a true global participatory kind of event, but it's just happening virtually. And I mean, Pace has historically been invested in these embodied experiences. And I wonder, do you see it, you know, there being a trajectory where things, you know, where, you know, Team Lab will be in this kind of scenario, people will be attending it virtually?
I think that when the virtual environment becomes one that's truly not alone, I mean, even though there were 10 million avatars in there that were, it's very rudimentary the way they can experience each other. Mm-hmm. And you can only experience the other avatar through your headset, just barely. You know, there is not a group experience yet in the virtual world. When there is a group experience in the virtual world, which I think is some time away, I think it will be an effective platform for artists to work in. But until then, it's going to be very hard for the artists to live there. They're certainly trying. Mm-hmm. A lot of virtual reality art being made and so forth, but I think that it's a tough environment.
I think it's funny that you see somebody like Jeff Koons doing VR art instead of having somebody be the Jeff Koons of VR art, which would be, I think, a very categorical difference. But thank you so much, Mark. This has been fascinating conversation. I just wanted to open things up to the audience in case anybody has a question to ask. And I'll wait two more seconds. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been